Welcome to this episode of the Strong Kind Podcast. This episode is with Brad Stolberg. Brad is an author. He's a thinker. He's a lifter. We had a really great conversation oriented around a lot of different things. You know, Brad described himself in this podcast as an artist and described how important it is to start to hone a craft in life. And we just got into some really deep and interesting topics that really span a lot of things, including like personal development, personal performance, living life well, and then our own struggles with health, both mental and physical. So it's a great conversation with Brad. Appreciate him coming on, and thanks for being here. Hope you enjoy this episode. So Brad, you reaching out to me was like, what the hell? Like, because I mean, I actually have followed you, I think, for a little over a year. I think I read The Practice of Groundedness at the beginning of 2024. So it was like early on in the year, and I appreciate your work a lot. And you're also in I think I'm very similar to you. You've you know, kind of struggled, well, not maybe kind of, but you struggle with OCD.
That's right.
You know, probably anxiety, which I mean, anymore, we can get into that because that's just one of those topics. But you reaching out to me was just like, holy shit, this is the power of the internet, right? So but how long have you I'm gonna probably call this episode sustainable excellence, right? But how long have you been into like that concept, and like what got you writing and how did you kind of get to this place where you're at now? Let's start there.
Yeah, well, first off, credit goes to my dear friend. He's like a brother, Justin Bosley, who sent me an email, I think, forwarded me some of your stuff and then called me. And he's like, you got to check out this guy, David Haggerty, because I think you dig his stuff. And I think he called you like a younger version of Dan John, but like a little more philosophy. And I'm like, well, that's music to my ears. So I think that what you are doing around strength training, in really, you know, it's not just training the body, it's training the mind, training the spirit, is so refreshing and such a welcome voice. Everything from combining kindness and strength, which is your whole MO, the way that you talk about pain and sensations in the body, just all of it. We're very much on the same page. So the pleasure is mutual. To answer your question, I have been thinking about this sort of thing for the last 15 years. I did a graduate degree in public health. And it was at that point that it became really clear to me that I wasn't as interested in working on the like sick care or the absence of disease, but was much, much more interested in what makes for human flourishing. Yeah. And this was also, you know, 2009, 2010, I'm in graduate school. It's very much internet 1.0, the blogosphere. Yeah. So I just started a blog on some of these topics, and yeah, it was totally like a labor of love for the longest time. And then some of my writing got picked up and one opportunity led to another. And it's what I've been doing ever since.
Yeah, I'm like 15 years behind on the blogosphere. I did have a blog in like 2010. I just committed to, I for some reason it was like, I think it was, who is it? What's Ryan Holiday. I'm a big Ryan Holiday fan, right? And my mic was off there. Ryan Holiday, but like, if you want to be a writer, just write. Like, it's not about right. The external accolades, right? And I've also just like, I'm a big Hemingway fan, like, you know, and you know, you just, Hemingway's is like, you sit down at the sit down and you just bleed, right? And like, it's so freaking hard. But and also, I think to some extent, I'm kind of raging against the AI machine. I'm afraid. It's not that I'm against AI. I'm afraid of the loss of human creativity and like critical thinking and writing. I that's like my biggest fear, is that we just lose the ability to critically think. And I think we're to some extent on the way there, right? yeah, so, you know, 15 years ago, like, you got started on this path, which kind of brings me to, well, you human flourishing, right? What does that mean? What does that mean to you? And like, where do we go wrong?
Yeah, I think that it's the most important thing that there is. For me, excellence or flourishing means involved engagement in worthwhile activities that align with your values and goals. So there's really three parts to that, right? The first is involved engagement. That is immersion, absorption, deep focus, studying a craft, learning a craft, whether that craft is picking a barbell off the ground, making pottery, or parenting a child, but it's giving something your all and respecting it and getting real intimate and close with it. The second part of that is worthwhile. So you can give staring at, you know, your basement wall your all. Is that worthwhile? I guess this kind of lies in the eyes of the beholder. But in today's world, I think that there's so much kind of cheap, shallow, superficial activity that can crowd out the real thing. So it's about, in your own life and for yourself, trying to deduce, like, where's the brown rice and where's the Skittles, and choosing the brown rice.
Yeah.
And then the final part of that is it supports your values and long-term goals. Well, this is really about knowing who you are and who you want to become. And if you can find something that checks those three boxes, where you get involved engagement, where to you it's worthwhile, and where it's in alignment with your values and goals, then I think that is a huge part of what makes life worth living. And that can sound pretty bold, but this is an age-old philosophy, East and West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that, like, oh man, I think everything you just said there was awesome. And just like, it's just breaking down what flourishing and excellence are. Like, you've thought it through, which is like one of the things I'm like really trying to work on when I write is like, what the hell am I talking about? Like, and some of it is just, I'm just getting in the reps. I kind of acknowledge that this year is going to be my, and I've put out content for 3.5 to 4 years through my business, right, as a way to just get people to see me. And I think I've honed some aspects of like short form content, but it's so superficial, right? I mean, even my content is deeper than a lot of people's content, but like what you just said there, you know, giving something your all, or like giving your all, what was the first thing? The first thing was,
yeah, I call it like involved engagement.
Involved engagement, like, yeah.
Intimacy, getting really close to something.
Yeah, like caring about something enough to look like an idiot when you begin it, and honestly feel like an idiot when you've continued it long enough to be like, I should be better at this than I am, which, like, that's one of those biggest things, like, what the hell does that mean? Like, you know, who are we judging this against, right? But like, why do people not do that anymore? Does that make sense? Or what stops people from doing it?
Yeah, I think that, like, the we get the candy version of it, so it's like the shallow version. So rather than read a book, you read a tweet or a social media post. Not that there's anything wrong with social media. I'm on social media. That's how we connected. It's a tool.
Yeah.
But if that becomes the end instead of a means to an end, then I think it's problematic. It is the person that hops from one exercise fad to the next and can only stick with something for 3 months because they're constantly upsold on the next great thing. I think it just requires more worthwhile effort up front, but it gives back so much more. I'm going to go back. I love this metaphor, but the Skittles and M&Ms, right? So if you're hungry and you're faced with Skittles or M&Ms, Skittles or brown rice. If you're hungry and you're faced with,
both of those.
Yeah, you could do both. But if you're faced with Skittles or brown rice, you know, you're probably going to choose the Skittles. Because they're super easy, they taste great, you're going to be like all over them from the get-go. And eventually what happens is you start to feel empty and sick of eating Skittles. But it's just still like you choose it. It's like an addiction, right? You just stuff your face with those Skittles.
Yeah.
Whereas eating brown rice, like the first couple bites are never going to be as satisfying as Skittles. But eventually you eat enough brown rice and you start to feel really satiated and good. And then you eat so much brown rice that you are able to have just a couple Skittles without binging on them because you kind of know what eating Skittles leads to versus what eating brown rice leads to.
Yeah.
And I think in every element of our life, there's like the Skittles version and the brown rice version. And the brown rice version always requires more effort, more focus up front, but it gives back so much more on the other end of it. For you and your audience, maybe in particular, the deadlift, right? For me, The reason to deadlift is every once in a while, you just get a feel for the bar.
Yeah.
And you feel the slack come out of it. You feel it starting to move. And you are just so in sync with that movement and that thing.
Yeah.
That takes, I don't know, you tell me, at least 3-4 years to start to experience. I'm sure someone that's been doing it for 2 decades says, you know, it takes 2 decades to experience. But that is like a long-term progression and a long-term path that you have to commit to, and you have to go through the mundane and the drudgery to get there. But it's that feeling that no AI can replace. You know, you can get a robot to pick up 1,000 pounds, but a robot can't feel that for you.
Yeah.
Same goes with writing. Same goes with a relationship. Same goes with having a child. But in order to get that feeling of depth and texture that makes you feel so alive, like you're having this organic human experience, well, you've got to put in a fair amount of effort up front, and you kind of have to say no to all the pseudo greatness that's out there, or the pseudo connection, or the pseudo depth.
Yeah, the pseudo exercises. I mean, because like, okay, like exercises are just tools, right? But like, you know, humans have a tremendous novelty bias, right? And I had a great podcast with somebody who is basically a nutrition and habits coach. And he's like, what is the biggest thing that you do for people? It's like, I maintain their attention long enough for them to reach their goals, right?
And ooh, like, damn, I like
that's
that.
That's a good way to put it, right? Because what they're, you know, you're constantly being bombarded with in fitness culture, diet culture, training culture. I mean, like exercises, again, you know, combining a lunge with a twist is fine, but like, there's something inherently hard about deadlifting heavy that cannot be replaced. Like there's something inherently hard about squatting heavy that cannot be replaced by another exercise, even if that exercise works, quote unquote, the same muscles, right? Like there's an intrinsic skill that you develop by doing the thing that makes you feel certain. Like, and it's just cool. Like hip thrusts are great. You know why people like hip thrusts? Because they can put on a bunch of weight and like they can say, oh, I'm doing a bunch of weight. But there's not a whole lot of skill in doing hip thrusts. That's why, you know, they're pretty relatively easy to learn, like easy to load, which is utility. Deadlifting,
I actually hate hip thrusts, as an aside. it takes so long to set up and to work up to a working weight. And I don't know if this is right or not, but the guy that coaches me, like to do hip thrusts to like 1 or 2 reps in reserve, like I just get a panic attack every single time. It's terrible.
Yeah. I mean, I just think lunging and Romanian deadlifting and squatting are just way more bang for your buck. They just don't look that cool, or that,
right? Because you don't have 400, 500 pounds in the bar.
It's like the thing that, and like it is for, you know, people want a big butt, and it is just a way to load up your hip extensors.
You get a nice glute pump. Yeah. But anyways, yeah. So without getting too in the weeds on training, although I'm here to do that too.
Yeah.
I think that to get back to your question, like why don't people do this? I think we are living in a world where we're surrounded by the synthetic candy version of everything.
Yeah.
And it takes more effort and more attention to pursue the deep brown rice version. And again, this is true for everything.
Yeah. Well, I just had one of my, I'm a coach. I'm a physical therapist. I just had one of my clients, like, you know, they do a weekly check-in and it comes in and it's a few questions and it's like, you know, I'm just not sure what direction I'm headed in. I want to be athletic and strong. And my approach to coaching anymore is just like, well, what does that mean to you? Right. You know, a couple of years ago, I'd be like, well, let's just switch up some stuff. Let's like make you in like, but really what it's about is like, what does that mean to you? And people don't know how to answer. People want these things, but they've never actually thought about what that actually looks like, right?
Yeah, and that gets back to like the values and goals, right? Like, yeah, be athletic and strong. Well, like if those are your values and goals for this, then define that. Is that the ability to carry groceries in from the car for a 75-year-old lady? Is that the ability to deadlift 650 pounds for someone that wants to compete regionally or nationally? And athletic and strong can mean both of those things.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And you have to, that's the cool part too, is like, you have to lay it out for yourself, right? Like you get to lay it out for yourself, right? I think that's super powerful. So the what you want to become, I feel like I was having this thought this morning. I play basketball a couple times a week, hopefully a couple times a week in the morning. And I'm like, if Nike put out a commercial that was like, it's you versus you, it would get like millions of likes, right? But if somebody waking up in the morning who's like faced with a struggle says that to themselves, they immediately don't believe it. Oh, it's just you versus you, right? They're like, nah, I mean, I don't know about that. Like, what's, do you get what I'm saying there? Like, when it's like the big company, the Goliath already like saying we did it, everybody's clapping. But when it's like that one, like, when it's you, and don't get me wrong, like, we can talk more about this. Like, there are social, you know, environmental, so many factors that go into sustainable or sustainable excellence, human flourishing, all that type of stuff. But there are also is like the decision to wake your ass up and do stuff. And I'm not saying like you need to wake up at five every morning. I'm saying like wake yourself up and get after your craft, right? And maybe your craft is just living well every day, right? And maybe we should believe in that a little bit, but we kind of don't. We've lost it, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. So there's a couple of threads to pull on there. The first is that I think that people love to default to extremes. And the two extremes here are personal responsibility, hard work, no one gets lucky, you own your future, pick yourself up by the bootstraps. And that's like utter bullshit. The other extreme is everything is systemic. You have no agency. Everything's outside of your control. And that's also bullshit. Like for 99.99% of people in 99.99% of situations, there is an element of systemic forces on you, and then there is an element of agency. And anyone that tells you otherwise, I think, is like thinking way too narrowly. Listen, are there certain circumstances where that's not true? Sure. If you are born in Syria right now, your agency is going to look a lot different than mine. But for the vast majority of people, probably the people listening to this podcast, you've got certain things where you're unlucky. You've got certain things where you're lucky. You've got certain things where you have high degree of agency, certain things where you have low degree of agency. With that is context. Taking that agency that you have, I think that here, what people often mistake is they think that they need to feel really good or inspired or positive or motivated in order to get out of bed and crush it. And what I have found over the last 15 years doing this work and researching is that it is very much the opposite that is true, that your emotion, your mood, your motivation follows the actions that you take. So you don't have to feel a certain way to act. You have to act to feel a certain way. Another way to think about it is so many people think that our being leads to our doing, but it's often our doing that leads to our being. In psychology, there's a school of thought called radical behaviorism, where this kind of aligns. And it essentially says that like, we can't control our thoughts. We can't control how we feel, but we generally can control the actions that we take, the behaviors. And by taking behaviors that aligns with our values, we then feel good and we start to get into more positive thinking cycles. This runs counter to all the self-help bullshit that's like, you know, the law of attraction and the secret and say your eight mantras and they'll become true, or just like think positive thoughts. No, like that's just not how the human brain works. It's not how the human nervous system works. But what does tend to work is show up, get started, take actions that align with your values, and then see how you feel. And I think that this is so important for people, particularly that have like a lot of like deep empathy and maybe a temperament that is like a little bit, I guess what people would in the past call like melancholic. Like, you know, you kind of like, you're a deep feeler, you have empathy, you see like everything that's happening in the world and like, you can feel down. And instead of being like, oh, something's wrong with me or something's broken, it's like, oh, I feel this way because I'm an empathetic person. I don't have to will myself to a new feeling state. What I need to do is show up and take care of the activities and people that matter to me in my life, and then I'll feel great. This is in the literature, it's called behavioral activation. It's thousands of studies, truly thousands. And then in all my reporting, like the best athletes, right? Olympic medalist, NBA basketball players, NHL hockey players I've spoken with, the vast, vast, vast majority of them, they don't wake up feeling great every day.
Yeah.
They struggle to get out of bed. They feel
it's
down. They wonder what's next.
Yeah.
Right. The only people that wake up great every day are the influencers whose whole job it is to make content saying they feel great every day. And generally they're doing it with their shirt off from a cold plunge and they're fucking full of shit.
Yeah.
However, people that are really doing it, like they go through the same range of emotions that any other human goes through. What they've gotten really good at is like showing up, taking action, and then hoping that the feelings will follow.
Yeah. Have you ever read The Expectation Effect by David. I can't remember his name.
I have.
So, I mean, like, so I'm also reading this, How Emotions Are Made by Lisa Feldman Barrett.
Great book. Yeah, I mean, all this stuff like runs together.
Yeah.
It's a big part of my book, Master of Change, where I like connect essentially how we respond to unplanned changes to like pain science.
Yeah.
And it's like essentially like if you have an expectation for something, then that expectation starts to shape your reality and how you're going to respond to reality all the way down to like the physical sensations that you'll feel.
Yeah.
And so much of our challenge is when our expectations and our reality don't meet. So if your expectation is that you got to feel like David Goggins every morning to live a successful life, your reality is not going to look like that. And then you're just going to beat yourself up. In the you versus you, you're not going to believe it. You're going to be like, I'm a failure. I have no energy. I can't do this. Yeah. If your expectation is more accurate, which is maybe David Goggins is performative. Maybe he's an alien. It doesn't matter. Most people aren't like that.
Yeah.
Hey, you can just get going and give yourself a chance. Well, then you can be kind, strong and kind, right? You can be kind to yourself, which allows you to be strong and do the thing.
Yeah. No, the concept of tragic optimism, you know, you've been a proponent and you've put that out there. That's very much me. I would probably say that I lean towards the side of, it's crazy because my optimism for other people, and I think this is also the power of relationships and whatnot, is like, if somebody's in front of me and it's like, they want to do that thing, I'm like, yeah, well, why not? Like, go do it. Like for me sometimes, and I still have that belief in myself, but you also like my identity as a kid was, I was the smart ass who like learned to get to like, I wasn't the most athletic kid and I grew up in a sporting context. So like, I learned to use like my smart assness and my hardworkingness to like, you know, get through things. And that has been very useful and it's carried me into my adulthood and it's been beneficial, but there's also now I have to like learn to be different ways. And like my pessimism in myself sometimes would hold me back from doing cool shit. And it's like, no, you have to have this optimistic yet realistic expectation, which again, like there's not a dichotomy necessarily, like there, you learn to function in different ways. And also like, dude, I don't know about you, but I was working with a therapist a couple years ago and like a lot of it was like, dude, you just, and you know, 2020 was a different animal for existential woes in our day and age, right? But like I was just afraid of dying, right? And I was afraid of seeing the people I love die. And so once I actually just dealt with that and was like, yeah, you're going to freaking die, dude. Like, and people you love are going to die. You know, how do you move forward? I started to just work through some of my suffering in that regard. Right. And, but you have to bring yourself to that level of depth, which a lot of people, again, don't necessarily do.
Yeah. They don't have the support. They don't have the tools or they don't have the language. I mean, and that's like the crux of tragic optimism in a nutshell, is like everything that we love is going to die and we're going to die. I mean, that's pretty tragic and despairing. So how do you go forward and live with optimism and hope and productivity, not in spite of that, but because of that, because your time is limited? And how do you hold those two things at once, the tragedy of loss and the blessing of life? And like, sounds pretty cliche, but it is the truest thing that there is.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about your mental health, your OCD. You know, like, cause rumination in a multiple of these goals, like I'm a big ruminator. I was anyway, I've gotten a lot better. I've gotten a lot better at noticing those patterns, but like rumination is one of those really horrible things for our body budget. Right. In the words of Lisa Feldman Barrett, like, cause you're basically just ruminating on a problem that like, you're not really going to solve, or if you should just go solve it. Right. Or it's out of your control. But like, that was where a lot of my problems stem from a few years back. And it was physically exhausting to me. I wouldn't say it was physically exhausting. It was like spiritually exhausting, which is a different concept, but like, tell us about where your struggles are.
Yeah. So, right now I feel like I'm in a pretty good place. It took a while to get here. Like lots of good evidence-based therapy from a really skilled therapist in an SSRI and medication. But 7-8 years ago now, when my OCD came on, it was just like utterly debilitating. I could not get through an hour of a day without just being completely blown up by like the worst, most intrusive thoughts, and then associated feelings of dread, of panic, of anxiety, like 10 out of 10, full body, Like, this is just physically painful. I would do almost anything to make this end. It came on for me in a really stark and sudden way, which was terrifying, but also in hindsight, kind of a blessing, because there was no like waiting around to get help. It was like, whoa, like my brain is broken right now. This is not normal. This is not like something is wrong here. I need to get help. So I got help really quickly. I got an OCD diagnosis within a month. And then I was able to start the treatment. But I was pretty sick for like a year. And then there was probably a, I don't know, 3 year period after that where I was like fine, but it was still a regular part of my life. And then I'd say over the past 3 years, it's like a very, very minor part of my life, at that.
I'm glad to hear that. Like, so mine was like, so, and you know, I never got, I was told that by there was no clinical diagnosis. Like multiple therapists were like, it sounds like you have health anxiety that's borderline.
Yeah. Well, the existential stuff is a big time OCD theme, right? This notion of like, I'm going to die. Everything I love is going to die. What's the meaning of life? How can I possibly enjoy March Madness? This basketball game's on. This is so pointless because we're all going to die.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously like we can say that now and it's like both true, but it's not making you want to like crawl up into a ball of depression. Yeah. But when you're in the thick of OCD, like that thought has so much emotional weight behind it that literally like you don't want to be around people.
Yeah.
Because what's the point of all this? And it's so freaking charged.
Yes. It's supercharged.
Live that 24/7. And then you wake up in the middle of the night and you're like, am I still depressed or am I not depressed? And then the minute you ask yourself that question, you feel depressed. Like I think people often think that OCD is like perfectionism or being really well organized. Like it is none of those things. It is trying to live life with this giant hand in front of your face. And that hand is like anxiety, despair, and depression.
Yeah. And which like, I think one of the things that I like about reading through that book is like, she talks about the degeneracy of a lot of human like neural networks taking us to the same place. Right. And so, I mean, I was also in hindsight, very fortunate because instead of it being that slow blanket decree, like, you know, like creeping sensation of like, nah, you know, life isn't what I thought. It was like pronounced and fast. And I started to have anxiety attacks. And, you know, I do believe like you hurt where you care, and I care about my physical health
100%.
Right. And, so like, you know, you go to the emergency room a couple of times and you have doctors look at you like your blood pressure is 120 over 74 and your heart rate's 70, like you're fine. Right. I think you're just freaked out. And then you cry in a doctor's office because you don't know what the fuck's going on with you. Right. And then so
was that your path like through health anxiety and like panic attacks?
It was like panic attacks just continue. So and then like, you know, my clinical brain is trying to figure things out.
Like, oh, what's wrong? Right. Adrenal cancer or whatever?
And I'm going down and my sister-in-law is like, well, like if you're having kind of mild weakness, you could have a brain bleed. And like, I'm like, oh, shit. And, you know, and like, I love my sister-in-law. Right. But she's a nurse and my wife's a PT. And, you know, so we're like, and this is what medical people do all the time. Everybody, I'm just going to tell you, like the medical people in your life are freaking psychos about trying to solve their problems. Right. And you know, a little bit of knowledge goes a long way in maybe effing you up, but then it just kept getting into this deeper and deeper irritability, deeper and deeper, trying to fix the problem, having to pee 24, feeling the sensation of having to pee constantly, like all these physical symptoms. And then it just was like, you know, I was spending hours a day. I would go work. I would cry after work because I couldn't, like, you know, people in pain. Well, it's pointless. Like, you know, I was working.
You're going to die.
Yeah. Like you're going to die. Exactly. Right. And then I'd go home and I'd try to solve the problem for 6 hours. The only time that I felt like
myself, that sounds a lot like OCD. And then like you go to Dr. Google and you're Googling everything and like you're trying to figure out like what's wrong, what's going to make it better. And like, you know, this is beyond my level of expertise and knowledge, but like I do think, and I think like the word nervous system gets misused a lot and it's kind become like
a
trendy
garbage
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. However, if nervous system is like our consciousness and mind-body connection and how that works together, I think to be in a persistent state of anxiety like that really messes up your nervous system.
Yeah.
Like I was having like muscle fistulations.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, so was I.
It's just like a mess.
Well, because I do, you know, all the models, there's
there's grains of truth in a lot of the models, right? So fight or flight, this, it's, you know, we, this isn't totally what's going on, but like, there is aspects of that where you're either, you're trying, I do believe in like, you know, to some extent I needed mental rest, right? And that's not necessarily physical rest, but I needed mental rest that I was not giving myself. And what that was basically doing was putting me in some type of like, your brain's just like, dude, you just need to chill. I don't know how to understand that, right?
Exactly. I think like there's a million metaphors. The one that I like to use is you have like all these like different alarm systems throughout your body, right? You've got like an alarm system for physical sensation, an alarm system for mental sensation, an alarm system for cognitive thoughts that are unpleasant. And when you're in the thick of something like this, that alarm system gets so highly tuned that the honk of a car will set it off because you're so scanning for threat.
Yeah.
And I don't know the systemic terms for this, but existing in that state just like messes up your being.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important to go get help sooner rather than later if you find yourself walking into that state.
Yeah. Like getting help, getting outside perspective, the, in hindsight, looking back and putting the pieces together in a logical way and be like, and thank God it was, because I do think this is what happens. It happens so slow for some people that they don't piece it together. And they look at a lot of these things that happen like, well, there weren't really any connections there, but like, dude, I was in crowds for like 2 years when we were in crowds. I was like, I was antsy because like, you know, I think where my first anxiety attack, I went to the gym, which was probably a dumb decision. I did wear a mask, but I went to the gym in like early July. It was right before the 4th of July. And my brain was like, you shouldn't be in here. You work with elderly people. Like you should be, this is dumb. You could be getting COVID. You could be spreading COVID. And I had a panic attack while bench pressing. I also maybe just suck at bench pressing. I don't know. But like, you know, and so, and I like where my, what my brain did was like, it knows what the stroke symptoms of a stroke were. And my brain was like tricking me into thinking I was having a stroke.
You're having a stroke.
Yeah. So to go back to like a lot of the things, you know, the practice of groundedness, you know, I read it, the concept I love, but like, what does that mean? Like, you know, what is groundedness, you know, is rather simply, relatively simply for us? Go read the book. Like, this is why you read books, people, so that you can extract things in a, you know, a logical manner from somebody who laid it out really well. But like, give us the Cliff Notes version of why that's important to you.
I just define groundedness as having a sense of internal stability that you can take with you wherever you go.
Yeah.
That is the most simple manifestation or rendering of groundedness. Now, how you create that internal stability to take with you wherever you go is, you know, a 280 page book.
Yeah.
But like what you get out of it is the imagery of a big redwood or oak tree that can stand amidst all kinds of weather, that can be blown around by the wind, but it's got this deep root system. In the case of redwood, it's actually not that deep, but it's connected to the root systems around other trees, which is a part of this.
Yeah.
But it's got a root system. It's underground that no one sees, but that's what gives it its stability in all kinds of weather. And I think that we're the same. Like each and every one of us has like a root system that's underground. And by paying attention to that, by watering it with attention and care, what we get out of it is this sense of stability, of groundedness, that we can be strong and be who we are in all kinds of circumstances, and that we can tell the truth. And I think that that's really important. We, at least here in America, it can seem like grifters and assholes and charlatans and people who lie, steal, and cheat are like kind of having a heyday and they're quote unquote winning. But I just think when you look at the long arc of history, one, those people don't win. And two, even for the short windows where they do win, it's a miserable existence. And I think now more than ever, it is important to have integrity, to know your values, to know what you stand for, to know the kind of actions that you want to show up and take, and to take them. Because once you give up on that, then like the bad guys have won. And I hate to say good guy, bad guy, but like the forces of malevolency have won.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the groundedness, when I learned the concept of equanimity, I was like, okay, that's something to work on, right? Like that's, you know, trying to be maintained. And it doesn't mean that you're not affected by things, but you're also just grounded in, like you mentioned, like your own values, which acceptance and commitment therapy, values oriented therapy was really useful for me. I think a lot of people should look into their values on, like, try to figure out what their values are. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't have value systems, right? Which also lends itself to acting with integrity, right?
I love metaphor, right? Because like we're pointing at these truths that I feel like people, they intuit and they feel, and they might even already know, but they don't yet have the words for. And my job as a writer is to help you find the words. Cause like once you have the words, it becomes more concrete. And you could think of it as like approaching the barbell, and it's on the ground. It's got all this weight on it. And there's this inclination to like jerk it off the ground and to rush the lift because you're a little bit scared. But if you do that, like you're probably not going to finish the lift.
Yeah.
So you have to have the confidence, and not the fake confidence. Like you can't fake your way into this. The learned skill,
yeah,
of taking slack out of the bar, of bracing, of pushing into the ground, of being patient, and of knowing that gives you the best chance at making the lift. And even if you miss the lift, it will be fine. That to me is such a metaphor for life, because how often do we like rush the lift in life? Like, yeah, we get anxious, we get scared, we jerk it off the ground, we just decide we're not even going to try. Yeah. But if you develop that skill and that confidence that only comes from putting in the reps and in practice, like I know in life, it's like, I know my values, I know how to act on those values. And I can just be confident that if I show up and keep acting on my values, the bar is going to move.
Yeah.
And I have to be patient, and I have to be willing to take the slack out of the bar, and I have to sit with that discomfort, and that anxiety never goes away. You know, I talked to Lane Norton, world champion in his age and class, powerlifter. And he talks about like feeling the anxiety because the weight's heavy. It's always heavy. So it's not about making that go away, but it's about knowing that you can sit with it.
Yeah.
And I just think like that is groundedness. And then to take that and apply that to life.
Yeah. Let's talk about who are your influences? I know you collaborate with Steve Magnus, who I love Do Hard Things. I love Steve's writing and but who are your influences? Who are your collaborators and like why those people?
So my biggest intellectual influences are probably Robert Persig, first and foremost.
Oh yeah.
Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, in a much lesser known book called Lila.
Lila, yeah.
That is much denser, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, didn't sell nearly as well as Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. My daughter's name is Lila. That book had a big impact on me. So he is by far my biggest intellectual influence. My next book, which comes out about a year from now, is really just like building on his work in so many different ways. Eric Fromm is a huge influence on me. Mid 20th century humanistic philosopher and psychoanalyst, wrote a book called The Art of Loving that is a beautiful book, a book called Escape from Freedom that I think sums up what's happening in the culture today, like eloquently. And then so many other good books too, a denser book called To Have or To Be. I'm really influenced by a media theorist named Neil Postman, who wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. Yeah. Who in 1984, when this book was published, predicted that a reality TV star would one day be the president and destroy the ability for people to think clearly. This is 1984. He had that prediction.
Yeah.
So you read that book and it's like, this guy's an oracle. This is the most prescient book ever. In terms of living people, Steve Magnus is my first and foremost collaborative partner. Cal Newport. Deep work, digital minimalism, slow productivity. He's one of my closest friends. We work together. We talk all the time. I don't know him as well, but I'm proud to call Ryan Holiday a friend, because I think I really admire his work and what he's doing with current events and really standing up for his values. So he's an influence of mine. And then I don't want to miss anyone. I'm sure I'm missing some people, but I guess like those are the foremost influences. But really, like Persig, Fromm, and I guess more recently Postman, I see myself in like that kind of humanistic lineage.
Yeah, well, I love that. When I was in, I almost went to medical school, and I'm very glad that I didn't, to be honest. But I did shadow a guy who was a palliative care physician, and he's like, and I'm like, you know, what made you do this? And he's like, there has to be humans in medicine, right? And like, he's like, a lot of people think they're humans, but like, and, you know, and he's like, I can tell that you care about humans. Like, that's like why you're even following me around, right? Because you are curious about like alleviating suffering, right? So I love that list. I haven't read any of Fromm, but I remembered that quote from something where, you know, somebody made that prediction. What is it? I also love So Good They Can't Ignore You. I read So Good They Can't Ignore You like last
great
year.
Great book.
Like, so good.
That's Cal Newport. Yeah, great book.
It's because it takes, we can kind of finish up here. I got to go take over baby daddy duty in like 10 minutes. So I'm just letting you know, but I appreciate this conversation. But like, stop hiding from the work and just get really good. Just say, what is it going to take for me to get really good? And that's usually, like you said, accepting the slow process, right? Accepting that you have to bring high intention on a regular basis, and just saying, you know, and like also accepting that your uniqueness, I think, and your uniqueness, people follow their passion when they should follow like legitimate hard work with interests that they have, right? So how is that? And like also just like Steve Magnus, you know, doing hard things. You're, you know, like you post about, for anybody who doesn't follow Brad, please go follow Brad on Instagram and go buy his work. But like, it's excellence doesn't come from cold baths. You know, if you like to take a cold bath, great. But like, it's not a hack. There's no hacks, right? So like, tell us, why do you care about that? What are you trying to do when you're posting stuff like that?
Well, I'm just trying to, one, remind people that like aren't into the pseudo grift, that like they're not missing out on anything.
Yeah.
And two, I'm trying to remind so many well-meaning people that are just looking for an edge, something to help them with the overwhelm, to get a little bit better, that there's an entire industry to take advantage of that desire that will sell them elaborate kabuki that is masquerading as the real thing, when the real thing is to know the fundamentals of whatever you're trying to get better at, get good coaching and your mentorship, and do that thing as consistently as you can in a way that has some kind of progressive overload or periodization. And I'm not just talking about for training your body. That's how you write. That's how you parent. That's how you build a relationship. Like, you need to challenge and stress yourself appropriately. And then you need to couch that in the body and mind's ability to adapt and to reflect and to evolve. And then you need to apply the stimulus again. And that is it. And it is so simple, but simple does not mean easy. And I think it's really important to give people that reminder. I think to So Good They Can't Ignore You, my two favorite musicians are both singer-songwriters. One is named Jason Isbell, and then the other is named John Moreland. And neither of these guys have like massive audiences.
Yeah.
Like none of them are what I would call like extremely commercial. And that's okay. Like, I love them because their stuff is really good. And I think that especially in this day and age where like there is this new attention economy that kind of like homogenizes culture.
Yeah.
I recently had someone tell me that like, you look at like top 40, everything, it's all the same. So all the top 40 songs, they kind of sound alike. You go to like, you know, top 40 revenue companies, they're all selling the same shit. He even said, you know, like you go to Pornhub, the top 40 Pornhubs, it's all the same. Like, it's all the same shit. Like, everything is getting homogenized in culture.
Yeah.
And I think part of being so good they can't ignore you is realizing that like, maybe you don't want to play that game.
Yeah.
And you don't need to be a celebrity on the internet. If you can be a celebrity with other people who care about the same craft that you care about, and by being a celebrity, I mean they respect your work.
Yeah.
That's the game that I want to win. And I think it's really important because like, there's a marketing game and there's a craft game.
Yeah.
And I think it's important not to confuse the two. It can get really despairing when you look out in the world and it's like, oh my God, the marketers are winning everything. I mean, in physical fitness, it's probably the worst. Like, anyone can go dope themselves to the gills, starve themselves, become miserable, cheat on their spouse because they're so miserable, and then flex their muscles and their abs and sell a 2-week online course to get shredded and get a million Instagram viewers. But that's bullshit. That's marketing. Like, the actual craft of coaching, you don't have time to do that all day because you're out there coaching people. Yeah. And I just think it's like, I see so many good people struggle because they're playing, like they're trying to win the wrong game.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, it's important to know the game you're trying to win. And that gets back to defining your values and what matters to you.
Yeah. Defining the game you're trying to win as an adult. Like, I love sports, man. I got up at 5:30 and I went and played basketball this morning. It freaking sets the stage for my day. I freaking love it. But there's a, it's probably never not been part of like youth sports, but like we're doing it more and more where we're like trying to capitalize on kids and like them playing specialization. Range is one of my favorite books ever by David Epstein, right? Like, and it's not that you shouldn't specialize. It's that there is a breadth of skills that if you develop those breadth of skills, then you can go specialize and be better suited for it. Whereas like people think that the shortcut is to just, you know, go all in on something. And it's so true. You're right. Like, I mean, and don't get me wrong. Me and my wife have been listening to Pink Pony Club for some freaking reason on repeat. And it's catchy and it's fun, but it's not anywhere as freaking awesome as Sturgill Simpson. Right. Or these, some of these people like, and like, yeah, I like Jason Isabel a lot. So yeah, I think
Sturgill Simpson's great. His new song about, I forgot what it's called, but something like Jupiter. Yeah. Barry's on Jupiter. Yeah. So good. So sad. I mean, I like sad songs, but yeah, just devastating. Very
good. Dude, I see stories. I listened like for a year. Like I just listened to that whole album nonstop for a year. And which is, you know, maybe that's my tendency to do things, but like, God, you said, oh, this is why I love lifting weights, because it's such a profound analogy for pretty much everything, right? You have to find the right dose of stress for the thing, right? You have to, you know, get intentional about it. Then you have to figure out how to balance that, because you can't train all the time, right? You can't, like, you know, you have to up your dose over time, maybe, right? And there's a lot of ways to do that. You know, running's a great analogy too. I think that's also a really good one. But yeah, when you start to see that, you can start to apply that to just about everything else. It's like, hey, like, you know, we have,
and there's such direct feedback.
Yeah.
And that I also love, like,
oh, that's a great point.
To feel you're in this, like this can sound elitist and you've probably been training longer and at a higher level than me, but like to feel your way into a good training groove is just like, it's back to like what makes us human. That is like such a cool, special thing. Like it's the definition of Robert Persick's quality. Like yeah, when you are paying so close attention to an activity or an endeavor that like you and it kind of start to merge. And yes, like you're still guided by your head and you're guided by your program and you're guided by your coach, but like you just kind of feel like I'm getting fresh now. This is what yeah, it feels like to be fresh. Up, like I'm pushing the edge, I'm overreaching, and I know I probably have like one more week that I can carry this amount of fatigue before it works against me. So like, I'm going to give it one more week and then I'm going to have the confidence to step back and then I'm going to get fresh again. To me, like forget the amount of weight on the bar. Like the reason I do this is because that like dance with yeah, progress is the most addicting thing there is.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it. And because the hardest part about training is your greed, right? It's your fear of losing it, and then you go into greed mode, right? And then you really do lose it, right? So it is learning to dance with it. You said something early on, it's kind of where I want to wrap up, but like the mind is the programming, right? The body is like showing up and doing it, right? Because nothing's going to happen if you don't show up and do it. And you need to have a, you know, you need to have a program. I do believe that a lot of programs can kind of take you to the same place if you show up, and depending on your preferences, but like the spirit is where you feel it. And that's what a lot of people miss. And when they're like doing this stuff is they don't, their spirit's not in it. Like they show up, they follow the program, but they never get like into that, you know, what am I doing this for? And how do I like do it well type of thing, right?
Yeah. And I think like that is, some of that is just temperamental. I think some people are more inclined to be engineers.
Yeah.
And to think like an engineer and to like, inhabit the space of an engineer. And we need those people, and, society couldn't function without them and their creations. Other people are artists.
Yeah.
And I think like, I am just more of an artist. Like I was a deeply feeling kid. I cannot build a Little Tykes basketball hoop to save my life. Again, I'm really glad that engineers exist. I don't work that way, but I can listen to a Jason Isbell song and I have a pretty good sense of like what Jason Isbell was feeling when he wrote that song, because now I feel it too. It's just a different way of being in the world. Yeah. And I think that, again, it's not better or worse, but I think for those who are wired to like appreciate art, you can start to see training is like a kind of art. Like I define art is it's something that elicits like a very strong emotional resonance and feeling. And for me, training is at its best when it does that.
Yeah.
And it's just fun, right? Like you do it again. It's a metaphor for life. Like you do it with other people, you make progress, you get injured, you have to be curious.
Yeah. I just feel so freaking much better, you know, after I go do it.
Yeah, I think the curiosity part of training is really good. So the same friend, I used to live in California. We were neighbors, and we would train together like 4 days a week. And once we started to get pretty strong, it gets scary. Like when you got a lot of weight on the bar, especially when you're squatting. And he would start to say like Brave New World before attempting like a new weight. And that kind of became a mantra for me, like Brave New World. Like it shifts you out of like, oh, this is scary mode to like curiosity.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, like this is going to be interesting.
Yeah.
And like, that's another thing that you get with training is like, you learn to take things that might be uncomfortable or scary and approach them with curiosity.
Yeah. I love that because you have to. I was talking to a client, came over and lifted this morning, and I'm like, so here's the thing. It's like, to get to that new level, yes, your programming has to be good. You have to be pushing hard, but you also have to be curious enough to see like, and kind of believe. You got to be curious on the side of, I can do this. Like, and what's awesome is like, when I load up weight on the bar and people don't know what it is, they usually do it because it's like, I believe you can do this. Right. And then they go and like, but if they would have loaded that 10 to 15 more pounds on there, they would have been like a little timid. Right. Which I think is, that's just the power of the human mind and like, or just the power of a lot of things. Right. So, Brad Stolberg, where can people find you?
Yeah. The best place to find me is, really the only social media platform I'm still active on is Instagram, where my handle is just my name at Brad Stolberg. And then the books are The Practice of Groundedness and Master of Change.
I appreciate you. This was a really good conversation. I hope to have another one with you, in the near future. And, yeah, I hope, I'm going to keep writing. So maybe we'll be hitting you up for some tips in the not too distant future. So yeah, we'll
I'm going to keep lifting. I really want to hit a 550 pull and, it's hard. It's heavy.
You'll get there. You got coaching and you got time. How old are you?
38.
Oh yeah. You can keep getting stronger until you're 80. So
yeah, it's crazy. This is like inside baseball, but, I pulled, what was it? 515. And this was just like end of year, kind of seeing where I'm at. And, it was heavy, but it kind of flew and it wasn't like in a meet setting or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't my coach. It's the co-owner of the gym who also coaches, who I trust and knows this.
Yeah.
And he's just like, fuck it. Like that flew, like, you know, unless like you need, my PR is 520. He's like, unless like you need to like see a PR, like go for it. Like load 540 on the bar.
Yeah.
Holy shit. 540 is heavier than 515.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I love the audacity, but yeah, you'll get there, man. Stay healthy. Availability is the best ability, or the best ability is availability. Stay healthy and keep doing the thing. So, hey, man, I appreciate you.
All right. Take care.
Peace.